The Comanche were led by an elderly, wizened chieftain named Mugwara, veteran of 100 raids and killings, but one now apparently desirous of peace. Looking eagerly about, like a scout on the trail, he studied each element that faced him in San Antonio, as if to satisfy himself that he was not heading into an ambush. And when he felt that the meeting could proceed, he signaled his women to remain behind, guarded by most of the braves, while he, 12 others, and an interpreter dismounted and marched to the council house, almost dragging the mute Lockhart girl with them. When he brought her into the room where the negotiators waited, with Commissioner Ascott prepared to offer clemency if only peace could be established, the Texian delegation gasped, and one man clutched Ascott's arm. "Jesus Christ, is that a human being?" It was a fair question, for when Ascott moved forward to give her comfort, the girl quivered like some tortured animal and looked at him with wild, uncomprehending eyes. It was with difficulty that Ascott prevented a break right then, but with great fortitude and holding back his own tears, he counseled patience, reminding his negotiators that they were dealing with savages who would have to be tamed by time. And he took the Lockhart girl, who would have been an attractive young woman had she been allowed to grow up on her ranch outside of San Antonio, and delivered her to the women waiting in the adobe house, where they had hoped to welcome at least 100 more. When they saw her, they began to weep, and the rangers outside heard their cries of rage. "Let's go in and get them now," one shouted. But the others calmed him, and the soldiers waited, fingering their guns. With the dreadful evidence of the Lockhart girl removed from the council house, it was possible to start serious discussion. But first, Ascott and his team had to know the whereabouts of the other prisoners. However, when they asked, Chief Mugwara lacked the English words for a conciliatory answer. "Not my prisoners, other tribes. You pay enough, you get them." Then he added a most unfortunate phrase. "How you like that for an answer?" Even Ascott, who had vowed not to be unnerved by anything the Comanche did or said, blanched. "Interpreter, tell Chief Mugwara that he and his dozen warriors will be our prisoners until he arranges for the other captives to be brought in." The interpreter, knowing that such an ultimatum must mean war, shouted the words in a jumble, then bolted through the door right past Captain Garner, who stood guard, and shouted to the Indians in the plaza, "War! War!" Garner, recovering from the shock of having the interpreter knock him aside, waved his handkerchief, at which McNabb and half a dozen others dashed into the council hall, where a general melee had erupted. Otto arrived just in time to see one of Maguire's braves leap upon Ascott and drive a long knife into his heart. The astounded commissioner gasped, and with blood gushing from his mouth, fell dead. This so enraged McNabb that he began firing coldly at any brave who could be separated from the white men, and the room became a miasma of gunsmoke, screams, and death. McNabb and others kept firing with relentless accuracy, and within a few minutes all 13 of the Comanche inside the hall were dead. Outside, in obedience to army commands, the soldiers stationed about the plaza killed 35 more Comanche before the others fled. 6 white men lay dead. It was a ghastly affair, a ghastly mistake, and it terminated any efforts to bring about peace with the Comanche. Captain Garner and his men saddled up to join the army in pursuit of whatever Comanche tribes might be in the vicinity. They came upon campfires recently abandoned, where corpses testified to the fact that the Indians, enraged by their betrayal in the council house, had savagely executed all their white prisoners. McNabb came upon one site where the rampaging Comanche had assaulted a Texian ranch. 2 wagons had been placed beside a fire, their tongues projecting over the embers. To the tongues, face down, had been lashed the living bodies of the men running the ranch, and the wagons had been adjusted so that the men would slowly burn to death. "Well," Otto said, "Martin met the Comanche." That happened in March, and for the next 5 months the Comanche retreated deep into the plains, tricking the Texians into believing that the massacre had been so devastating there would be no further raids. But 2 days before the August moon, one of the largest bands of Comanche ever gathered for a single raid assembled well west of San Antonio, and under the leadership of skilled chiefs, prepared to spread fire and terror across Texas. Cunningly, they slipped past military outposts, keeping well to the north of Gonzales, and fell with great fury upon the unprotected town of Victoria. They captured the entire town, burning and raping and killing. Corpses were scattered about, and more than 200 horses were herded off. On they went, down to the little town of Linville, where Finley McNabb's Baltimore wife had landed with her 2 daughters. And here, at the edge of the sea itself, they rampaged unmolested all through the day, burning more, killing more, and stomping in fury at the shore as certain clever townspeople took refuge in boats, standing well out into the bay without food or shelter until the savages departed. With these 2 incidents, the shooting of the Indian chieftains during a parley at which they were supposed to be protected by the white man's code of honor, and the burning of Victoria and Linville, the Texians spoke no more of rapprochement with the Comanche. War of annihilation was seen to be the only recourse, and it would be fought with terrible intensity by both sides. In 1850, the slaughter would be appalling. In 1864, when the whites were engaged in a great civil war of their own, with their men assigned to distant battlefields and unable to protect their homes, the Comanche would ride right into towns and set them ablaze. In 1870, the same. And up to 1874, this terrible war would continue. Along the frontier, Deaf Smith's rule prevailed. Never let a Comanche capture you. Better you shoot yourself in the head. When Otto McNabb heard of the disaster at Victoria, he had to assume that his mother's unprotected home, and his Aunt Maria's as well, must have been assaulted. So he sought permission from Captain Garner to ride down to see if the women had survived. And the captain said, "Sure, but watch out for stray Comanche." So Otto rode south from Sevier County, and as he approached Victoria and saw the desolation spread by the Comanche 6 days before, it became clear that only a miracle could have saved the Garza women. When he reached the Guadalupe River and started down it toward Victoria, he found only burned-out ranches. "Around the next bend, I'll see it." And when he made the turn, he did. The 2 houses, which had known so much love between Texian and Mexican, were gone. The drying corpses of the 2 women still lay under the hanging oak, where they had fled to escape the lances. "I better bury them," Otto told himself matter-of-factly. But digging in this hard, clayey soil had never been easy, and he had to be satisfied with very shallow graves indeed. "But you could call it Christian burial," he thought. That evening he bunked in one of the houses in Victoria that the Comanche had not burned. The man in charge told him, "Señor got himself killed out in the street. Señora, she is with the other family." He said it would be all right if Otto stayed there, and he even helped prepare some beans and goat's meat. But Otto could not sleep, and at about 9 he told the man, "I think I better go back and say goodbye." The man insisted upon joining him just in case, but Otto said, "No, it'll be all right. They've gone." He rode slowly back to the ruins, giving no consideration as to what he might do when he reached them. The Comanche moon, as it was called in these parts, that bright full moon which encouraged the Indians to raid, was waning. But it would remain a crescent in the sky until morning, enabling him to see once more the landscape he had loved so much when he first came to Texas. The silent Guadalupe, that first important stand of trees after the bleak marshes of the shore, the gently rolling hills that gave the land variation, the oak tree from which Zave... Suddenly he became aware that someone else was near the tree. "Who goes?" he called, readying his pistols. "Amigo," came a strong Mexican voice. "That you, Otto?" From behind the oak, his own pistols at the draw, came Benito Garza, who had ridden north from the Nueces Strip to pay homage to his sisters. Standing quietly, he pointed with a pistol to the new graves. "You bury them?" he asked in Spanish. "I did," Otto said. Slowly, the two men lowered their pistols and moved closer. "What brought you?" Garza asked, still in Spanish. "You hear about the big fight in San Antone?" "Those Comanche can be bastards," Garza said, still in Spanish. "Why are you speaking Spanish with me?" "I don't speak English no more," he said in English, and after that explanation, he used the language no further. After they had found rude seats on the blackened remnants of a wall, Otto asked, "If you think the Comanche are such bastards, why did you work with a Cherokee against us?" Garza was late in replying, so Otto said, "We found papers on the dead spy Flores." "Is he dead?" "On his corpse were these papers. They named you as a principal. We have orders, I suppose you know, to shoot you on sight." "Are you going to try?" "Why side with the Indians? Will you be partners with the Comanche next?" Garza laughed freely, easily. Punching Otto on the arm, he said, "You try making friends with the Comanche. Go ahead, try." "They sure raised hell here," Otto said. "What will you do with your land?" And Garza pointed west toward where the McNabb dog run had once stood. "It was never our land, Benito. It always belonged to your sisters." There was silence for a moment. Then Otto reached out with his boot and kicked at some blackened clods. "It was your sister's land, and now it's yours." "Your government will never let me have it, me fighting on the side of Santa Ana." He ignored his later conspiracy with the Indians. "I'm sure they will," Otto said. "We want to forget the battles." "You don't want it?" "I have no use for it. They gave me land up on the Brazos, for being a hero, I guess." "You Norte Americanos got your revenge at San Jacinto." "You heard, I guess. Santa Ana went free, used our good money and rode back to Washington in style, talked with the American president and all that." "You have not heard the last of Santa Ana," Benito predicted. "He'll be back." "And you'll be with him?" "The moment he issues his grito." "Who will he be fighting?" "You bastards. Who else?" "And you'll fight with him? Against us?" "Certainly." Otto pondered this a long time, then said slowly, "You saved my life. I saved your life. We're even, Benito. Next time we meet as enemies, draw fast, because I'll kill you." Garza laughed easily. "Little boy, I taught you all you know. I can handle you." "But you taught me very well, Benito. Next time..." They parted. No handshake, no farewell words of the affection each felt. Over the graves of the women they had loved, they parted, each believing that Mexicans and Texians could never share this land. When Otto returned to Sevier County, he was a forlorn young man, bewildered by the tragedies that had overwhelmed those he loved. Good, bountiful Maria and Josefina slain. Martin Ascott, most promising lawyer in the nation, killed in San Antonio. Betsy Bell and her infant child adrift. By the time he reached Sevier, he had concluded that it would be improper for him to continue living in the shed at the Ascott place. For although he was 5 years younger than Betsy, his continued presence could cause comment, and this he would not allow. But when he came to the shack and started to collect his few belongings, Betsy said, "What in the world are you doing?" And when he explained, she burst into robust laughter. "People might talk? Otto, I'm trying to run a farm. I'm trying to care for a baby. I need help. I need you." Sometimes, when he took a side of venison into Campbell to barter for things like flour and bacon, he was aware that the townspeople did talk in whispers, just as he had expected. But one day the schoolmaster, Reverend Harrison, stopped him as he was passing and said, "Son, you're doing God's work in succoring the fatherless child. Take Mrs. Ascott this basket of food my wife cooked." When Otto thanked him, he added, "But, son, if you continue to live there, I do think you ought to marry. It's the only decent way." Such advice caused Otto greater confusion than any he had previously known. Even the death of his father had been easier to fit into the grand scheme of things, because fathers traditionally died sooner than their sons. And right there, in that simple statement, resided the source of his confusion. "She's so much older." He was barely 18, Betsy Bell 23. But she was also a mite taller, and had always looked upon him as a child. She was a woman wise in the twists and turns of the world, and mature enough to be his mother, a role she had adopted from the start. How vast the difference between them seemed, not only to him, but also to her. So he continued to live in the cramped shack he and Martin had built, and sometimes in the evening, after an arduous day of work, he and Betsy would sit and talk about the future. And one night she said, "You must start looking for a wife, Otto, and I must find a father for my son." He was staggered by this bold statement, then listened as she ticked off the local girls whom he might reasonably court. She even went so far as to invite one of them to visit, and the three spent a long Sunday afternoon getting acquainted, and it was obvious that the young woman liked Otto. The visit had one salutary outcome. Otto no longer feared that Betsy Bell might be interested in him as a husband. The presence in Texas of a widow of good character who had a son to raise became widely known quickly, and one morning a fine-looking gentleman from Nacogdoches appeared at the Ascot cabin to introduce himself. He was from Mississippi. He was a widower. He had a farm and a daughter, and he had brought with him two extra horses, in hopes that Mrs. Ascot would consider riding back with her son and her family goods. He was a pious man, a Baptist, and said, "I'd not contemplate this, ma'am, unless we was married proper before we started." And Betsy asked, "How did you know about me?" And he said, "Your father." And he showed her a letter. "Jared, my beloved daughter Betsy Bell is a widow in Sevier County, Texas. If your sorrow over the death of your Norma has subsided, as God always wants it to, ride down and make Betsy's acquaintance with my blessing." At the wedding, held in Reverend Harrison's school, Yancey Quimper served as best man, and when Joel Job asked in his resonant voice, "Who gives this woman in marriage?" Otto said, "I do," and it was on his arm that Betsy Bell approached her new husband. For some days Otto lived alone in the Ascot cabin, now shorn of its warmth and liveliness, and he spent the time brooding about the inescapable manner in which the world turns, bringing day after night and the passage of months and years. He knew almost nothing about girls or women, and had been astounded when one of the rangers on a night ride in pursuit of bandits told him that a woman can have babies only so long, you know, and if she misses her chances, she misses. He had never spoken to Betsy Bell about this. Indeed, he had been completely embarrassed that Sunday when she invited the girl to visit. But he now supposed that she had ridden north to Nacogdoches so soon after the death of her husband because she felt the passing of the years and the limited time she could expect on a frontier like Texas. "And what of me?" he asked in the darkness. He was diverted from such mournful speculation by the eruption of another presidential campaign in which the men at Quimper's Ferry were determined to prevent Sam Houston from returning to power. There was much loud talk about emasculating the old drunk, and one evening when Yancey had himself imbibed rather heavily, his cronies persuaded him to pen a vitriolic attack upon Houston's morals, courage, thievery, treason, and bigamy. When Houston refused even to acknowledge having read the widely publicized assault, Yancey was goaded by his friends into challenging Houston to a duel. Had he been sober, he would not have dared. Houston handled the Quimper affair with that sense of the ridiculous which characterized so many of his actions. Informed by his partisans that Yancey, now sober, was paralyzed by the anticipation of a duel in which he was likely to be killed, Houston sent him a letter which treated him as a serious opponent. Widely circulated, its ludicrous nature not only delighted Houston's rowdy partisans, but also provided serious ammunition for those sober citizens who were determined to end this murderous folly of dueling. "My dear Yancey Quimper, I have before me your challenge to a duel. My seconds will await yours, and we shall fight at the spot and time they elect. Since I am the challenged party, I shall demand horse pistols at 5 feet. However, I have been much challenged of late, and at present have 22 duels scheduled ahead of yours. I calculate that I can fit you in about August of next year. Until then, I am your humble servant, Sam Houston." Allowing and even encouraging a brief spell of hilarity, horse pistols at 5 feet, they'd blow each other's guts out, and who can imagine Sam Houston being anybody's humble servant? He put a sudden stop to it, and began speaking of Quimper as if the latter were an authentic and dangerous duelist. This achieved two purposes. It brought public attention back to the absurdity of dueling, and it created the image of President Houston dealing courageously with a hazardous opponent. He abetted the rumor. "I'd be damned lucky to escape that duel with Quimper. He's a killer. At San Jacinto, he was a savage, nothing less. Quimper would do me in." When Yancey heard this assessment, he did not appreciate what Houston was doing. And when no one took the trouble to explain, he actually began to believe that Houston was terrified of him. And as time passed, he further convinced himself that had the duel taken place, he would have dropped the big drunk. He could see Houston appearing at dawn, badly inebriated, shooting wildly, then crumpling under the devastating fire of Yancey Quimper. Free Texas being what it was in those wild days, many citizens were tricked by Houston's game, and in time it was credibly reported that the duel had taken place, that Houston had reported drunk and had fired but missed, and that Quimper, gentleman to the end, had deliberately fired in the air rather than kill a former president of Texas. Yancey was now not only the hero of San Jacinto, but also the man who shamed Sam Houston in the duel. With this fresh-minted glory, Yancey felt encouraged to take a step popular with Texians. He awarded himself a military rank, and since he was now famous for two different acts of gallantry, San Jacinto and the duel, he made himself a general, and as soon as he had done so, an amazing transformation occurred. He stood taller. He shaved his ineffectual mustache. He sent away to New Orleans for a uniform with a decided French swagger, and he discarded his big slouch hat in favor of a smaller one with a neat cockade. He also began pronouncing final G's as if he had been to military school, and referred often to West Point, without actually claiming that he had enrolled there. When General Quimper learned that his friend Judge Finnessy was scheduled to hold sessions in Victoria County, he left the inn, explaining, "I have some legal work to clean up." By paying assiduous attention to all property law passed by the Texas Congress, he had learned that the 10,000 acres of choice land along the Guadalupe River, called the Guarlupe by many Texians, once owned by the dead Garza women, was in jeopardy because their brother Benito, who should have inherited it, had proclaimed himself to be an armed enemy of the nation and had thus forfeited any right to own land in it. The case that General Quimper brought in the Victoria Court was so complicated and long drawn that Judge Finnessy had no chance of unraveling it. But when the court was not in session, Yancey explained the complexities to him. He also attended court in his new general's uniform, which lent dignity to his claims. And when he encountered any members of the huge Garza clan who were defending their shadowy rights against him, he was immaculately courteous, as if his only interest in the suit was to see justice done and the land distributed equitably. In a series of decisions so perverse that no sensible man could have explained them, and certainly not Judge Finnessy, who handed them down, General Quimper achieved ownership of all the Garza lands. And then, as a result of additional suits equally intricate, he was awarded a further 22,000 acres, the courts invariably transferring title from indistinct Mexican owners to this very real hero of the Republic, who obviously knew Texas land law better than the judges, and certainly better than the original owners. Thousands of acres, which had once been owned by Trinidad de Saldana, were now passing quietly into the hands of enterprising Texians like General Quimper, until in the end, more than 2 million of the best Nueces acres would be so verified, as the Texian judges explained, or stolen, as the owners complained. The lands did not always pass quietly. When Benito Garza heard of the theft of his acres by Quimper, he led a daylight raid boldly into the outskirts of Victoria, where, with the help of 16 dispossessed men like himself, he gunned down a Texian who could be considered a sheriff. So once again, the ranging company had to be sent to the Nueces. When Otto returned, with 3 more Mexican bandits to his record, he sat alone in the Ascot kitchen, staring at the wall. At any sound, he whipped about, hoping it was Betsy Bell returning with her child. And after several such incidents, he realized that it was the baby he really missed. How proud he had been to serve as its father when it cried for attention. A wolf howled, and he leaped in frustration. God, I've got to do something. Thousands of miles from the new nation, in one of the many German principalities, historical events were painfully forging a solution to Otto's problems. The Margravate of Grenzler was in trouble. Not only did economic crisis grip the Rhineland, but a frightening surplus of population inhibited the normal functioning of society. Young people could find no homes, and older ones no employment. Germany itself remained divided because no central power had yet arisen strong enough to force consolidation. There was talk that perhaps the sturdy kingdom of Prussia might provide leadership, but only the sanguine could hope for this, because each petty ruler, like the posturing Margrave of Grenzler, held jealously to his ancestral rights, refusing to accept leadership from anyone more powerful or more intelligent. In the old days, the 1100s, for example, Grenzler had played such an honorable role in defense of the area, standing like an impregnable rock at the confluence of rivers down which invaders from the east must come if they sought to attack established centers like Cologne and Nuremberg, that its stubborn ruler was given the title Margrave. And, although justification for continuing of this august honor had long since vanished, descendants of those ancient heroes clung to it. On a spring day in 1842, Ludwig Allerkamp, 40 years old and the father of 4, prepared to leave his bookbinding shop at Bergstrasse 16 in the capital town of Grenz for an interview he dreaded. As if to exacerbate his anxiety, his wife came to the door to remind him of his duties. "Keep in mind, Ludwig. 1, 2, 3. And to illustrate her points, she ticked off the numbers on her fingers, which she folded back into her palm as she counted. Ludwig was extremely fond of his wife, Thekla, and he did not interpret her reminders as heckling. No, she was simply bringing to his attention once more the perilous condition into which the Allerkamp family had fallen. So as he strode along the principal street of the town, toward the rude castle at the far end where the Margrave himself lived, he lined his 2 children before him and kept his eye on them, using them to tick off his duties the way his wife had dropped her fingers. 1, he told himself as he looked at his son Theo, aged 20, I must insist that he have the right to marry. 2, my daughter, this was Francisca, age 13, must be allowed entry to the school. That took care of his children. He himself was the 3rd obligation. I must have more salary for tending the castle library. I really must. Good God, we're near to starving. He was not exaggerating. Across the German states, and especially in the cold northern areas, a series of unprecedented winters had produced successive crop failures, making food so scarce and costly that families were fortunate if they ate 2 meals a day, because sometimes they ate none. It seemed as if the entire system had broken down. Farmers could not produce enough, and what little food they did bring into town they could not sell, because people had no money. A tedious barter system had developed, much as the peasantry had operated 400 years earlier, and there was constant grumbling. "We must be very polite to everyone," he warned his children, "not only to the Margrave, but also to the Gräfin, and especially to the bailiff, for who knows, he may be in a position to influence decisions." He spoke with almost a classical ring to his voice, for he had attended two universities, Jena and Breslau, as had his father and grandfather before him. He had hoped to attain a professorship and was more than qualified, but the present depression had begun just as he finished his studies, so no positions were available. At first, he had tried teaching in the town school, but the pay was so miserable that no man could even dream of getting married. About this time, he met Thekla during a walking tour through the countryside west of the capital, and once he saw this woodland sprite, blonde and lively and with a voice like a wood thrush, he knew that they must marry and earn their living as they could. Never had either of them regretted this hasty decision. Despite privations, they had enjoyed a good and loving life, and on the meager salary he earned as a bookbinder, plus what he had picked up from doing casual jobs, they had raised their three boys, and then grave, beautiful Franziska. It had been worth the struggle, more than worth it, for both husband and wife felt blessed 100 times. But now they were close to starvation. As he approached the castle, a stubby stone building whose outer walls dated back to the 1300s, he took a deep breath, surveyed his children's dress, and tugged at the bell cord. After a few moments, a bailiff opened the big brass-studded door and looked down his nose as the intruders entered an anteroom whose walls were made of unfinished rock and whose floor was paved with massive slabs of polished stone. A door opened, and into the waiting room came the Gräfin, as she was called in deference to her family position before marriage. She had once been a great lady, but now her 60-year-old face was painted like a girl's, and she wobbled as she swept forward, faced Franziska, and imperiously extended her right arm. Franziska did not know what to do, nor did Ludwig. But after a moment of their agonizing indecision, the bailiff pinched the girl painfully on the arm and whispered hoarsely so that even the Gräfin could hear, "You're supposed to kiss the hem of her dress." This Franziska was most eager to do, but as she bent forward, the bailiff pushed her heavily on the shoulder, whispering again, "Stupid, you must kneel." And in his roughness, he forced the child down onto the stone pavement, from where she grasped the hem of the great lady's gown and brought it to her lips, as all women in Grenzler were obligated to do when presented to this august personage. But that was not the end of the affair, for when Ludwig saw the burly bailiff smiting his daughter, as it were, he lost his temper, slapped the man's hand away, and said impulsively, "Do not strike my daughter." The Gräfin, who was embarrassed by nothing, saved the day. With a tinkling laugh that drew attractive wrinkles across her heavily powdered face, she said, "He wasn't striking her, simply teaching her how to respect her betters." And she stalked off to be seen no more. The bailiff then led them out of the reception hall and into the throne room, a vaulted affair with rock walls, and on a dais a heavy chair occupied by an imposing ruler. Margrave Hilmar of Grenzler was in his 70s, a big man with a red, puffy face, white hair, and bushy mutton-chop sideburns. For almost 50 years he had dominated this castle and the surrounding lands. As a youth, he had been to Heidelberg, had lived for a while at the court of Bavaria, and had risen to the minor rank of colonel in the army of one petty German state or another. He enjoyed reading, and had developed an affinity for the clarity of Schiller, whom he considered vastly superior to Goethe, who tried to encompass too much in his poems. He had dabbled in astronomy, and had even purchased a small telescope with which he entertained his guests, for it was just powerful enough to show the moons of Jupiter, a sight which he still considered unbelievable. He was in some ways an enlightened monarch, but his territory was so small, and in recent years so poor, that he could accomplish little. He believed that the stringent measures advocated by Prince Metternich had saved Europe from turmoil, and he would have been astounded had one of his subjects told him that Metternich was one of the sorriest forces ever to hit the continent. Each year that the Austrians' reactionary policies prevailed, principalities like Grenzlar fell deeper into despair. There are many things in this world worse than an orderly revolution that turns tables upside down for a while. For in such violent periods, men still eat and marry and think great thoughts and rearrange their prejudices and launch new ventures. And one of the worst alternatives is a deadly hand of repression which inhibits all forward motion and stifles all adventure. Ludwig Ollerkamp and his son were about to experience the soured and withered fruit that grew upon the tree cultivated by Metternich. Excellency, my son Theo comes before you seeking permission to marry. As Ludwig prepared to assure the Margrave that his son had found a proper girl in one of the ruler's subjects, the daughter of a well-regarded family, the Margrave raised his hand to stop discussion, and when there was silence, he asked the two questions which at that time ruled Germany. Has he a house into which he can take his proposed bride? No, then he cannot marry. And when this was settled, he asked, has he a job which pays a living wage? No, then certainly he cannot marry. Ignoring the father, the ruler turned to face the son. This is a harsh decision I must render, but throughout Germany the rules are the same. No house, no job, no wedding. Before either of the Ollerkamps could protest, he added in an almost fatherly tone, but we can hope that as the years pass, conditions will relax. Maybe you'll find work. Maybe a house will fall vacant. People die, you know. When that happens, come back, and I shall gladly grant you permission. Now, hurting inside, Ludwig pushed his daughter forward and said pleadingly, my wife and I wish that an exception could be made for this child. She should be in school, learning her numbers and music and... The Margrave nipped this line of nonsense quickly. In this land we do not educate ordinary young women. He would discuss the matter no further. So Ludwig, almost crushed by now, launched his third futile plea. Excellency, I work long hours in your library, taking charge of accounts, seeking new works for your inspection, rebinding your most valued editions, and many other duties. I do most urgently request a larger salary from you, most urgently. Now the Margrave really hardened, because this was an attack on his generosity. In his own mind he had never really needed Ollerkamp's assistance, and had employed him in one trivial capacity or another, merely because he was educated and pleasing to talk with. However, in recent months he had detected in his librarian's comments slight traces of instability. If you are unhappy with the terms of your employment, Ollerkamp, it can be terminated. Oh, no, Ludwig cried with obvious terror. Oh, please, Excellency. He groveled, and both he and his children knew he was groveling. The Margrave seemed to enjoy it, for he pressed on. I can think of six young men in this town who would be most happy. Please, Ludwig begged, and the interview ended. But as the bailiff was leading the Ollerkamps from the castle, Ludwig suddenly told his children to return home without him, ran back to the throne room, and threw himself upon the mercy of the Margrave. Excellency, I beg you, allow us to emigrate. As soon as that fearful word emigrate was spoken, the slouching Margrave stiffened. His hands gripped the griffin armrests, and he rose to an impressive standing position. Never speak to me of leaving Grenzlar. We need you here. Ludwig, realizing that once broached, this vital subject had to be pursued logically, regardless of how angry the Margrave might become, forged ahead. Excellency, I have four children, and only one house to leave one of them when I die. What are my other three to do if they can find nowhere to live, no place to work? God will provide in His own mysterious way. But if you would allow us to go to America as you did Hugo Metzdorf, worst mistake I ever made, we need men like him working here. But if my sons can find no work... Allerkamp, the old man shouted in real irritation over being goaded into revealing his true reasoning, Grenzler and Germany need your three sons. We could be at war with France tomorrow, or with Russia, or with that unreliable fellow in Vienna. We never know when we shall be attacked. But if my sons can't marry, if they can't work, they can do the noblest work allotted man, fight for their homeland. Their country orders them to fight for it, but will not allow them to live. Talk like that will get you into grave trouble. But Metzdorf writes from Texas. The mention of this short, memorable word, Texas, infuriated the Margrave, because there circulated throughout Germany in these years many enthusiastic accounts of travel in the western portions of the United States, with special emphasis on the advantages of settling in Texas. Most impressive was a book which the Margrave had acquired in 1829 for his own library, Gottfried Duden's Report on a Journey to the Western States of North America. Even the Margrave had been so excited by its roseate evidence and reasonable arguments that he had, in his first flush of enthusiasm, committed the error of allowing a dozen of his Grenzler families to emigrate. But when he realized that he was losing valuable manpower, he called a halt.